Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, co-host of Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today on the show, we're talking unions, a hot topic here in Vermont and across the country. Starbucks workers all around the country and in South Burlington are moving to unionize. Like many unions before them, they're asking for better conditions, hours, and benefits. Just last month, resident physicians at the University of Vermont Medical Center voted to unionize, and the UVM faculty union protested last week. They're calling for better wages. The list does not end there. Nurses at Champlain Valley Physicians Hospital Medical Center in Plattsburgh are threatening to strike as they negotiate a new labor contract. The uptick in union activity is not just anecdotal either. We checked in with the Vermont State Labor Council, the AFL-CIO, and their membership has grown from 10,000 before the pandemic to 11,400 members today. They currently have a dozen different organizing projects in the works. Later in the hour, we're going to be joined by a labor sociologist who's been studying organized labor and worker justice during the pandemic years. A historian from Barrie is also going to join the show to help us contextualize everything with stories from Vermont's earliest unions in the 19th and 20th centuries. But first, we're joined today by Gaz Romp, a barista at the South Burlington Starbucks and one of the organizers of the store's union petition. Gaz, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I'm happy to be here.
Thanks so much for being on the show. And listeners, we want to hear from you today as well. Are you part of a union or do you oppose them? Do you have an interesting story about the history of Vermont unions? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.org or tweet us at vermontedition. All right, Gaz. So first, tell us a little bit about yourself and your history at Starbucks. How long have you been working at the South Burlington Starbucks, and what attracted you to the job?
Hi. Well, I'm 19, graduated from St. John's Barry Academy in 2020. Mm-hmm. I've been a barista at our store on Shelburne Road a little over 2 months now.
And what attracted you to this job?
Well, I've worked in the food and retail industry for a little over 3 years now, and I've just gotten a lot of experience with it, and it is a job that is readily available to me, and I was attracted to the inclusive environment that Starbucks promised and very much has, and what's kept me staying there is the wonderful people I've been able to call my coworkers and friends now. It's a wonderful team that we have on Shelburne Road.
Well, it sounds like an open and inclusive community, a job with a lot of great coworkers and maybe some good perks. But you and your colleagues are organizing. What has motivated you to join the union effort?
Well, as you know, the National Starbucks Workers United campaign has been exploding since December, starting in Buffalo and reaching all the way to Seattle, where the company was founded. There's over 250 stores currently waiting for an election, and roughly 50 are already won and unionized. We just found ourselves in Vermont on the front of this historic labor movement, and after talking to my coworker Cam about grievances about a month in, I was invited to a meeting with reps from Workers United and Buffalo. And after that, I got right away talking to all my coworkers, and we all pretty much agreed that, especially after this pandemic, wages have stagnated. We're chronically understaffed. Our job is impeded every day. It's difficult for us to make quality drinks in a succinct amount of time. But we love it here. Starbucks is a great company, and we already have competitive benefits and wage. We just want to make it work better for everyone and see a lot more of the profits that we generate for the company on a day-to-day basis.
Now, you mentioned being chronically understaffed, which I know I bet a lot of our listeners can also empathize with. You know, that's a problem that spans industries in Vermont. And I'm curious to hear from you about how you and your colleagues believe that a union could help with understaffing. Have you spoken to union reps about like what they've been able to do in this area for other companies or industries?
Yes. Well, the first thing I would say is that a union job is a great job to have, especially in this market. And I believe that in and of itself would attract more people, you know, higher, you know, union wages and union benefits, you know, protected by a long-term contract, that will entice many possible applicants. The issue is, all corporate is allowed to offer here is $15 an hour in the regular benefits. And when we get new partners on the floor, they don't last more than 2 or 3 months usually because they're hastily trained and poorly paid. And especially as so many Vermonters are entrenched in the housing crisis right now with rents, the price of rent just skyrocketing as wages stagnate. $15 an hour and the current benefits offered by Starbucks just doesn't cut it. And it's not just about Starbucks specifically. I would implore workers of all industries right now to demand that you see more profits that you generate for the company. The billionaire class of we're living through a second gilded age, I would say, right now, and too many people at the top profit, and we don't get to see any of that. We're just paid for the price of our labor and not a livable wage. And everyone at our store is behind these sentiments, and our local community, local organizations have been tremendously supportive and helpful, and I'm very confident about the future of our union.
Well, we reached out to Starbucks ahead of this show to ask for a comment about the organizing efforts. And a spokesperson wrote back and said, and I'm quoting here, We are listening and learning from the partners in these stores, as we always do across the country. And they went on to cite a letter from the interim CEO, Howard Schultz, who said, again, I'm quoting, "We will become the best version of Starbucks by co-creating our future directly as partners." But last month, Schultz told store leaders that the company wouldn't offer its new benefits program to stores that have voted to unionize. So, Gaz, I'm curious, do the CEO statements have any effect on your own organizing efforts?
I would say that they haven't stopped us at all. We recognize this new policy as an intimidation tactic, trying to sway the table and create an unstable environment for workers who are deciding whether or not to join our union by having these benefits only apply to non-unionized stores. They're trying to entice people who have been with the company longer to not join the union by offering these very minimal benefits, when I would just say that these benefits only apply to 80% of Starbucks' workforce in the country, people who have been with the company less than a year, and they're very minimal, and a long-standing, strong union contract in which we demand the company the rightful wage and benefits, that is much stronger than these bribes and intimidations from corporate. And we also recognize this policy as just another action within their union busting campaign. The NLRB just filed a lawsuit against Starbucks for over 200 violations of our federal right to organize. People have been fired, intimidated, threatened, spied on, and it is destroying our brand nationwide. And I would just ask Howard Schultz to think about working collaboratively, co-creating this company with an organized workforce in which every single worker is represented. And these don't just come from the top down. They come from both of us working together, corporate and the partners.
We're speaking with Gaz Romp, a barista at the South Burlington Starbucks and one of the organizers of the store's union petition. And if you have thoughts about Starbucks's movement towards unionization or other unionization efforts in Vermont or the region, give us a call, 800-639-2211. Let's go now to Donna, who is in South Burlington. Donna, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up something that doesn't happen much in conversations on unions. I really do support small local unions. I think they can do a lot of good. But there's a lot of unintended consequences that people often don't think about. When unions become very strong, and particularly national unions, or even big local unions in the construction trades, a good example is like electrical workers unions in New York City that have contracts that say if you have to have somebody there for 20 minutes to hook something up, you have to pay them for 8 hours. So a lot of the negotiated agreements that these unions work with discourage, are very, very discouraging of business people for, you know, and also, you know, occasionally you get contracts that are written that guarantee pay raises through level increases that have nothing to do with the local ability of the community to support it or even have anything to do with the employees real deserving, you know, whether or not they deserve to get.
Well, Donna, thank you so much for your call. And Gaz, I would love to hear your thoughts here, you know, from someone who is in South Burlington, where the Starbucks that you work at is located, who's saying that, you know, there might be some drawbacks to unionization and that it could affect the profitability of business or have some other unintended consequences for the community. What are your thoughts there?
Of course, yeah. With such big, long contracts, there can always be room for error. And I would say that the union that we are organizing with, Workers United, has a lot of very progressive ideas about union bargaining and contracts. And we would never bargain for a contract where that we think that would allow low performance, like not good partners to get by. One of our major grievances is that people who aren't good on the team can last very long here because we're wrapped up in corporate bureaucracy. And being a part of a union, definitely, it's a shame because you get a whole other bureaucracy above you that you have to worry about when you're in a union. But I would say that Even with the potential for error that comes with unionization, I believe that the workers' rights and compensation benefits, everything it means to be a worker, I believe that those are better when they're in the hands of the workers themselves rather than a one-way where a corporate has all the control. So whatever contract you negotiate, at the very least, it's going to be way better than what corporate offered you, not on the negotiating table.
Well, Gaz, I know that being a barista means that you have lots of interactions every day with customers and people in the community. Has the idea of the Starbucks in South Burlington unionizing come up in conversations with customers?
Yeah, ever since we went public, our regulars have been coming in and coming out as extremely supportive of our union. One of our favorite regulars who gets a venti extra lemonade, black iced tea lemonade with a cup of ice, was so supportive and got buttons and was ordering merch and is going to come to our rally on Saturday. And it was wonderful. We've seen so much support from the customer base. We also have this little area for customers to come write a little note to us. And so many of them have just been like union strong, solidarity, workers unite. It's been great. And so many local communities like the local chapter of the DSA, the Vermont Labor Council, the IBEW, they've reached out and lent their support and solidarity for our campaign. It's been really wonderful. Something else too, sometimes we get so many union strong copies that the orders get confused because everyone's under the name Union Strong, which I think is a funny issue to have.
Yeah, that's only at Starbucks unionization issue, I think. Well, we only have about a minute left with you, Gaz, but before we let you go, have you been having any conversations with Starbucks workers at other locations in Vermont? South Burlington is the first one to potentially unionize. Are these efforts happening in other parts of the state?
I've begun having conversations with partners at a few different stores. There's one location that we're showing a lot of promise. I'm going to keep it all under wraps for now. But
fair.
Yes, we're going to be encouraging and imploring our fellow district stores to file. And I will be visiting your locations and inviting them to events and trying to get as many partners in on this union as we possibly can.
Gaz Romp is a Starbucks barista and an organizer of the union petition at the South Burlington Starbucks. Gaz, thanks so much for your time today. Now for some broader context. Jamie McCallum is an associate professor of sociology at Middlebury and the author of the forthcoming book, Essential, How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Struggle for Worker Justice. Jamie, thanks for joining Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined today by Marjorie Strong, an assistant librarian at the Vermont Historical Society in Barrie. Marjorie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jamie, let's start with you. Now, anecdotally, it seems like there has been a growth in labor organizing in recent years and even in recent months. Is that actually the case? Is there data to support it?
So, yes and no. There has been growth very, very, very recently, but for the most part, in other words, since 2022, the number of people joining unions through the NLRB, like Gaz and his coworkers, has increased dramatically. Like it's up 60%. During the pandemic, unionization generally declined slightly, and so you know there's some of that. But yes, recently spurred by, you know, some of those campaigns, including the Amazon ones and some elsewhere's, there's been a recent surge.
So 60% in the past 5 months or so, that seems enormous. What's changed?
So people are really, I think, both upset and encouraged. So for the last couple of years, as you know, everyone's aware, service workers especially took the pandemic pretty hard. They either lost their jobs and therefore got by on CARES Act money and whatever have you, the ARP, or they worked through the pandemic. And those jobs, many of them were lousy and rotten and dangerous and did not dramatically improve at all, even as the pandemic has we've seen it shifting. And I think that, you know, some of what we're seeing now is sort of a comeuppance from a lot of major employers from simply mistreating their workers for the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marjorie, I want to get to you in just a moment. But first, I see we have a call from Liz in Montpelier, who's actually the executive director of the Vermont Labor Council at the AFL-CIO. Liz, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. So this is a great conversation. I just want to say that as a labor council, you know, what we've been doing is trying to just get the information out there on how to form a union and organize because, you know, a lot of labor councils have not, unfortunately, been doing this work over the years. And we have been so fortunate to actually adapt one of the trainings developed by one of the lead Starbucks organizers, Alex Riccio, on how to form a union. He started this program called How to Form a Union through the Institute of Organizing Unions. And we've given several of these programs over the last year and have just seen so much demand among the workforce here in Vermont on how to form a union, responding to, of course, all kinds of, you know, declining conditions, right, that we're seeing here and more broadly across the nation, including wages and hours and everything else.
And Liz, where can people find that information if they're looking for it?
Absolutely. So if you go to our website, vp.aflcio.org, you'll see a tab, how to contact a union organizer. And if you fill out that form, I will probably get back to you personally and help you with the next steps in forming a union and get you in touch with the appropriate union for your sector, and also invite you to any future how to form a union organizing trainings that we have, and everything else, and just peer-to-peer mentorship on how to actually build some power in your workplace.
Well, thanks for your call, Liz. And if you have been part of a union and have had a good experience or a bad experience, give us a call, 800-639-2211. Now, Marjorie Strong with the Vermont Historical Society, you have studied the history of unionization in Vermont and in towns like Barrie and Rutland. As we talk about this kind of historic mid or post pandemic stage that we're in right now. Of course, there's mountains of history that have led up to this moment. And I wonder if there are any moments that you can point to in Vermont history that could shed some light on what's happening today. Any key moments in Vermont's history of unionization?
Well, I can certainly speak specifically to Barrie, but being at the Vermont Historical Society, I do have a slightly broader view. I think the first, I would say, worker action that historians have identified in Vermont is in Bolton, when Irish workers, fearing that they weren't going to be paid, went on what we could say strike. They weren't unionized, but they stopped work. And the reaction from authorities was pretty fierce. They were sent armed, deputy sent, and they were arrested, and then the whole work there stopped for 2 years. So it was a strange and probably not triumphant moment for labor organizing. But so there's sort of a lull, because Vermont is a very rural state, and it really isn't until it starts industrializing in the 1880s that you see labor unions beginning to form in the state. Barrie, because of the immigrants bringing a tradition of trade unions and socialism, was one of the early adopters, I would say, of labor unions.
Right. There were a lot of immigrants from Ireland and Italy, right? What kind of traditions were they bringing with them?
Well, actually, the first immigrants to Barrie were Scottish from the city of Aberdeen, and they had a very strong trade union tradition.
Hmm.
So they were used to organizing, and they organized. They organized in a number of ways, one of which was to form a mutual aid society. That was the first thing they did in 1884, Clan Gordon number 12. But then the Italians started arriving in the 1890s, and they brought with them basically their experience as socialists and anarchists, especially the socialists were better at organizing, I would say. And they joined forces with the Scots. So the immigrant groups, the local people would think of them as outsiders, but they by then had lived in Barrie 10, 20 years. And the population of Barrie grew from a village of 2,000 to, by 1910, 11,000 people. So, and about a third of them were immigrants. So they had a huge impact.
Now, we're talking here about trades like stonecutters, granite workers, mill workers. Jamie McCallum with Middlebury College, what are some of the industries that have successfully organized in this pandemic era and seen positive results? I'm guessing they're a little different than the ones we were just talking about with Marjorie.
Sure. Yeah, I think the days of Italian anarchist stonecutters in Barrie is behind us.
Though if they're out there, please call in.
Yeah, please call if you're out there. Yes, we would love to talk to you. So the pandemic was interesting because it highlighted groups of people we came to know as essential workers, who were largely, we didn't think pay much attention to for the most part in our society. But it especially highlighted the importance of unions, I think, in healthcare, education, retail, some of those sectors that we interface with on a more regular basis and for our very survival. And so in that realm, there's a lot of evidence that, you know, our lives were made better when workers had a voice in the job, better wages, sick leave, healthcare, et cetera. And our lives were imperiled when those workers did not have those things.
Could you give us an example of that?
So, you know, if you think about education, teachers across the country spoke up when administrators and school boards, et cetera, tried to send kids back to school too soon. They helped lobby for their families to get vaccinated to help prioritize their vaccinations. They fought for better ventilation in schools. I conducted research with a research team that showed that as teachers' unions were stronger, those school districts were more likely to adopt mask mandates, which we know stopped the spread of COVID. So in education, there's those examples. In healthcare, it's always been the case that unionized nurses and CNAs and LPNs provide better healthcare. Like, they're able to advocate for their patients. They have better access to life-saving supplies like PPE, and they're more likely to have protections themselves that afford them time off when they're sick.
And so you specifically studied nursing homes as well. Is that right?
Right. So there was a research project I did with the same group of people led by Adam Dean, actually from George Washington. And what we found was that nursing homes where workers had unions, there was significantly lower mortality rates from COVID among residents and significantly lower infection rates among workers compared to their non-union counterparts. This was true across the country. So in other words, if your loved one or you were in a nursing home, you were less likely to die and less likely to get sick if there was workers at a union. Mm. And I think those kinds of benefits are rarely discussed when we think about just the general significance of having a union in a society today.
Well, we're getting lots of calls in, so let's turn to the phones. Tim in Chattahoochee, New York. Tim, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Just a comment that sector industry, and unlike manufacturing industries in which the workforce was pretty much at a disadvantage because corporations would often threaten to pull up stakes and move to another nation. If Starbucks continues to want to sell their product, they're not going to sell their product out of Canada or Mexico. The powers and the people that work the baristas.
Well, thanks for your call, Tim. And I do want to get to that concept that you're bringing up in just a moment about how remote work or about how, you know, companies moving to more international business models could affect these unionization efforts. But first, let's get in a couple more voices. Let's go to Jack in, I believe, Burlington. Jack, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I guess I just want to make a brief statement.
Sure.
Since you were just talking about unions and education, that I'm part of the UVM Staff United Union, and it has been great for us. Similar to what the guy was mentioning, it's because of the union pressures that we've been able to make sure the administration creates just fair wages, a better work environment, and benefits for everyone on staff, since it's the staff that keeps the university running.
Thank you. And what's your position on campus, Jack?
I am a librarian.
Great. Well, thanks for calling and sharing your experience. Let's go now to George in Rutland. George, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, George.
What to say? Hello. What to say? Back in the mid-70s, I was a shop steward on a rail gang, a traveling rail gang that went between pretty much Boston and Cleveland, replacing rail with these quarter-mile lengths of continuous welded rail. I was a shop steward for 120 people. The union at that particular point was kind of controlled by these Italian mob guys out of Brooklyn who wrote contracts that we would not necessarily approve of.
Huh.
But what we ended up doing by having concerted effort in terms of kind of slowdowns, working to rule, That means obeying all of the rules of which the railroads have got these little books with several hundred ways and procedures of doing things correctly. We would basically get to and because we traveled, we would actually be able to get extra overtime. We were actually able to control the amount of hours that we worked. We could get out early because we knew how much the company expected from our boss, and we could compare ourselves to all the other rail gangs around the Northeast and the Midwest, and we figured out exactly how much we could squeeze these guys. So we could slow the production down. We could we had on point of production control, and which made our boss crazy. One day he called us for a meeting in which he basically took his hard hat, threw it on the ground, it bounced probably 10 or 12 feet into the air, and said, I can make you work, but I can't tell you how fast.
Well, George, you seem like the kind of person who has a lot of stories that I would love to hear, but unfortunately we're going to have to keep moving forward. But Marjorie, I do want to ask you about the railroad workers. Like George, I know they have a long history of unionization here in Vermont. Is that right?
Yes, they do. Though, actually, as I said, I know mostly about the granite industry and about Barry as a labor center. So they all intertwine. I mean, it was funny listening to, the statement about Barry is mostly granite and that they're the ones who unionized. But in 1910, actually, 90% of the working population in Barry had unionized. Far, far beyond the granite industry.
90% of the population in Barry had unionized?
Of the working population.
Okay, but wow, that's quite high.
The children, maybe not. No, well, it was very, very high. It was, they had basically, in fact, the Barry retail clerks had two unions in Barry. So they were unionized. The barbers were unionized. The printers were unionized. The cigar makers were unionized. Many. Oh, the musicians, by the way, were unionized. They had the Musicians Protective Union. It was a very concerted effort. In fact, they had a central labor union to coordinate all the unions. Barry,
like
at
a
that
union
point
for
was,
unions.
Exactly. It was kind of a union powerhouse. And at 1910, they thought, okay, we're good to go. And unfortunately, like with the epidemic, sort of the reverse, world events really harmed them. World War I was a huge blow to these unions, mostly post-World War I, and also the Red Scare that happened in 1920, because many of these are immigrants. So that was very chilling. So it is in 1920 that we get the euphemistic American plan with the owners fighting back. That meant that a non-union, the right to work, stepped in. And it took another 20 years to creep back to probably where they were, not even quite to where they were in 1910. So there's all these waves up and down that happen in labor history. Sometimes success can do you in. I think.
And Marjorie, do you happen to know what percentage of workers in Barry are unionized today compared to that 90% number at the turn of the 20th century?
Well, actually, I don't, because modern history, and I'm really bad at that.
That's all right.
Current history. But I will say 1952 was the last major strike in Barry, mm-hmm. and it was not a successful strike. And that also... the world economy depressed all the union power, I would say. Barry still has unions, but they're much quieter. And it really is industrial. There is no retail clerk union anymore, or the musicians union is more of a national organization, local.
Well, listeners, if you were part of a union in Barry or any other part of the state or region, give us a call, 800-639-2211. We'd love to hear your experiences with it. Now, Jamie, we were just talking with Marjorie about the kind of joking idea of a union for unions, but an organizing body for union members is a very real thing then and now. And you told my producer that you also think that the current national labor Relations Board has had a part in this current momentum in unionization that we're seeing nationwide. For listeners who don't know what that agency is, can you explain?
Sure. So the National Labor Relations Board is the government agency that basically oversees, you know, a lot of union elections. So if you're if you work somewhere and you want to have a union, one way you can do it is to petition for a vote, and the National Labor Relations Board will conduct that election. So the head of the board is appointed by the president. So Biden fired Trump's NLRB appointee, mm-hmm. like the first day in office, who was basically just an anti-labor scoundrel, and appointed someone better. And so the board has been trying to keep up with the amount of union elections that have been filed this year. Gaz mentioned that there's actually a backlog of union elections just at Starbucks, which is true. The board has not significantly increased its staffing over the last two decades, though it covers more workers. And so one thing, you know, one significant labor reform we could make would be to better funding and better staffing for that agency. Because, you know, right now, if you petition for a union election, you're going to have to wait a long time for that election to be both to happen and then the results to be verified. It's a part of a larger problem, really, in a way where in America, we don't really have like labor law. We have law that protects employers' ability to dodge, you know, dealing with their workers in a democratic way. And so part of, you know, reforming labor law would be strengthening the board.
Let's go now to Ellen in Barrie. Ellen, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I am a member of UVM Staff United. I am actually standing with a picket at this very moment in front of the main administration building at UVM as our union, which represents 1,350 clerical, technical, specialized, and professional staff, is at the bargaining table with the administration. We've been doing it for 8 months, and we're waiting them to show that we're valued at UVM. But we built this union from the ground up a year ago, so I will say that the labor movement is alive and well here at UVM.
And what exactly are you asking for, Ellen?
We're asking for livable wages for all of our staff. 250 people in our unit make less than a livable wage. We're asking for an end to wage stagnation for all of us and an ability to advance in our jobs at work.
Well, Ellen, thanks so much for giving us a call from your spot out there at UVM picketing. Let's go now to Ted in Moortown. Ted, you're on the air. Go ahead. Ted, are you with us?
I think it's Deb in Moortown.
Oh, apologies. Hi, Deb. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi. Yeah, hi. First of all, I want to thank Ellen for being out there on the picket line. I am Deb Snell. I'm president of AFT Vermont, and we represent the newly formed staff at the UVM Health Unit, or the UVM United. So I obviously can say the labor movement is alive and well. AFT Vermont, we're like the really only like the fastest growing union in the state right now. And we continue to organize. We just had a new crew join us from Community Health. We have Planned Parenthood and obviously UVM Staff United. And we're getting calls from all over the state with different healthcare and higher education groups very interested in forming a union and being represented.
Well, Deb Snow, with the AFT, why do you think unionization with your organization has been, increasing in recent months or years?
You know, I think part of it might be the pandemic, but I think the bigger part is people are just so tired. We're losing our middle class in Vermont. People are leaving, and the people that want to stay need a reason to stay, and they need to feel respected and that they're getting recognition for a job well done.
Well, thanks so much for giving us a call, Deb. Jamie, curious to hear your thoughts in reaction to Deb's call and to the call we got from Ellen, who is picketing at UVM on behalf of their union. Are these types of efforts things that you are seeing in nationwide trends, or is this something that's really moving forward here in Vermont specifically?
Sure. I mean, first of all, best of luck to Ellen and Deb out there. It's a really, it's hard to appreciate the risks and that people take when they go out on a picket line, because you know bosses are brutal, and the degree to which people will, you know, have to stand up for themselves, stand up for their coworkers, is not to be taken lightly. So sending a lot of appreciation and respect to those folks out there. It's certainly not a Vermont thing. There are workers walking pickets right now across the country in healthcare, education, in retail, in heavy industry. There has been a sort of uptick, I would say, in labor militancy in the last few years, some of which is even being led by folks without unions. And so there is the pandemic, for all its hardships, I think did, you know, was to some extent a wake-up call for so many of us who realized that people deserve better. By and large, Americans like unions. Like, well over 60% of Americans support unions. Only 10% have one. The problem is that people are basically being kept from getting what they want by management, by employer associations, by the state, what have you. And so we have to, it's folks out there on the front lines who are really showing us that, you know, we have to support them getting what they want and what they deserve.
Well, speaking of those front lines of picketing and striking, Marjorie, I'm reminded here of a strike from way back in 1933 that I think I read about for the first time on the Vermont Historical Society's Instagram page. It was among Barry granite workers and stonecutters. And those two unions, if I remember correctly, had two very different outcomes in this strike. Could you tell us about that?
Actually, I think they did have a bit of a different outcome, but really they really marched together in this strike. The problem was that the governor at the time interfered. At the time when the workers went on strike, the mayor of Barry actually led the parade as the workers marched through the city, and there was quite a lot of support. But one of the major granite employers, Jones Brothers, was friends with Stanley Wilson, the governor, and at their behest, he brought in the National Guard, which immediately sparked confrontation. And they also tried to bring in scabs, which in Barry are always called bozos. Nobody knows why, but that's what they're called. And there was just a great deal of tear gassing, there were confrontations, there were arrests, but in the end, it ended up being kind of a draw. I think that the 33, they didn't lose ground, and they gained a little bit of ground. Partially, as I said, the governor was not supportive. It's interesting that by 1940, when George Aiken became governor, he was much more sympathetic. And he's the one who formed the Vermont Labor Relations Board. Not sure if that's the exact name, but but he actually was trying to join together farmers and workers in urban areas, saying that they had the same interests, that the split that happened in Vermont between rural and urban was artificial. So he was a real game changer in many ways. So it's interesting. Those in power can really affect what happens with unionization.
Yes, and that reminds me of Jamie's comments about the differing heads of the National Labor Relations Board under different administrations. Now, Jamie, we have just a couple more minutes here, but I am curious to hear if you have heard of any recent examples of a major corporation that has changed enough of their policies or worker conditions to effectively stave off a union and genuinely improve conditions for workers. Is that a possibility?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. I mean, any corporation right now is legally allowed to make conditions better for their workforce. So the question is, do they do it satisfactorily? I mean, Mike, you know, Howard Schultz's move to raise wages at Starbucks across the country is obviously a direct result of the unions, the unionization movement. And will it work? It's a good question. Amazon did the same thing. I mean, when Amazon first encountered like grassroots opposition in its warehouses, it moved to increase safety precautions, increase COVID checks, raise wages, increase time off. It just simply wasn't enough. Like, people were still outraged and they're still organizing. And so I think it's rare. It's not uncommon that companies do things that convince people to delay thinking about a union. That's very common. But it is, things bubble back. Raise wages are temporary, and those things can easily be revoked unless you have a union contract.
Jamie McCallum is an associate professor of sociology at Middlebury College and the author of the forthcoming book, Essential: How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Struggle for Worker Justice. Jamie, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Marjorie Strong with the Vermont Historical Society, before we let you go, any last words for current union leaders about what lessons they might be able to take from their predecessors, or any historical books or references you think that someone interested in unions should check out?
Well, one of my favorite authors on union history is Richard Hathaway. He was a professor at Vermont College. And the other book that's kind of the standard in a way is called The New Deal in Vermont. It's by Richard Judd, which is a real classical look at what happened during the New Deal. So those are two of my favorites, I would say. The takeaway is, I guess, hold strong, keep together, no divide and conquer, you know?
Well, Marjorie Strong, thank you so much for your time today. Marjorie Strong is an assistant librarian at the Vermont Historical Society in Barrie.